Before we kind of get into maybe some of these things that I've kind of prepared a little bit for, I thought it would be good if we started off a little bit talking about this mass shooting that took place in Texas. And not so much talking about it from a political standpoint or whatever, but talking about it from a couple of standpoints. The first one is a theological one. But the second one, which is just as important in my way of thinking, is how would you try to navigate through that with somebody who went through that. Now, you might be thinking, oh, that's theoretical and it's hypothetical. That's not something, we're faced with, but when you are, it'd be kind of nice to know you had a little bit of discussion or training a little bit on how to think properly so that, it's easy to go in there with the right intentions, but kind of, a 5-year-old's got the right intentions of wanting to serve mommy and daddy breakfast in bed, but you know what happens when carrying the trays and doing things like this. So I just thought it would be kind of a little bit of we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but I try to put myself in the position of if we had a church there and we had folks that went through that, how would we seek? It's almost like a Job situation, really, if you think about it. What would we do, or how would we, what our thinking mechanisms would be when you got people like that who are grieving? And I know we can scratch our head and say, gosh, I don't know what I would do. If I know if I went through that, I don't know, how I can make it through that. Or if I was, that was one of my best friends that went through that, I don't know exactly what I would say or do, whatever. Well, at least what we can do is at least talk a little bit about that so that, and I gotta tell you, it's probably gonna be something like that. It's gonna be not like that, but it's gonna be something that it's gonna roll up to you in some way, shape, form, where you're gonna maybe have to deal with something along those lines. And they're going to either look to you for, some sort of relief, or they might ask you questions, which I get asked many times when those things happen. And how do you navigate that? How do you know when to speak? And how do you know when to, be like Job's friends and don't say anything for a week and just be there for somebody? And how do you know when they're asking you questions and maybe you don't answer them, or maybe you do? Where are those lines drawn? Now, look at a tragedy like that, which is an unbelievable proportion. And it's just kind of, I think of those families, but I also think of of people that would be in a position that I don't know what kind of help or comfort, they're going to try to offer. But what are some bullet points that we can take with us and say, when there's tragedy or there's difficulty or there's, and usually it happens in a quick amount of time. And it usually happens for someone that they're not on the radar, like the 84-year-old, doctor that's probably in failing health. They're probably making preparations for his departure. It makes it a little bit easier for the family. It's still hard, but nevertheless, when you have something that's pretty much traumatic, how can you be a help without being a burden? Or coming in there and say, gosh, I just don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. I just feel like a fish out of water. Well, you don't want to be a complete fish out of water. You want to be able to know a little bit of how to be able to comfort, like Paul would talk about comfort, from the God of all comfort and mercies, so that he was comforted with people that came to him. We were comforted with Titus when he did this, when Timothy did that, gave us these reports. And so we want to be able to know how to do things in a certain way, if we can, with some wisdom that can help others. First question is, at least from what my understanding is, that you have a big, big advantage when you have a correct theology. When you have the right framework of life in general, I mean, reality, God, evil, good, when you have all those boxes checked, so to say, and not just, I learned these things in Sunday school, but I believe these things to be true. It is a great buoyancy during those tumultuous times. Now, that's true for us when we go through them. When I'm dealing with somebody else on the outside, for me, the first thing that you're going to see that comes to the surface is their theology or lack thereof. It's going to rise and you're going to see it. And whether it's going to be sadness or anger or, whatever else, their theology is on full display. And, how do you handle something like that? Yes, Jesse.
Just a real short little blurb here, but you're right. And that little verse, New Testament says, rejoice with those that rejoice and weep. So we have a command whatever weaving evolves to weave properly in a way that goes itself down.
Yeah. I mean, that thing brought me to tears. I was listening to it yesterday. It's like, and you see the faces of these parents come into the school and going to get the news for the first time. You know, it's like, how do you process that? You know, so one of the things I think is good, we start off with some of this, is that you have to be able to enter into their grief. You got to be able to put yourself in their shoes. You got to be like, I'm a parent or grandparent or whatever. And it's almost, I don't want to do that. It's just painful even to pretend to do that, let alone watching these people. They're not pretending. I mean, they're in it, you know, and you realize or you get an idea of the depth of pain and sorrow, you know, that they're going through. That would be one thing to start with. But is there.
To parallel what Jesse's talking about, 1 Thessalonians 4, not it's about those who are asleep, but you may not grieve as others who have no hope. So weeping, grieving is part of our makeup.
Yeah.
And as a process that we do, in forward and in hope.
You know, I had a guy who was a friend of mine. He passed away because of COVID, Don Hoy. But one of the things he did during the week, he was a chaplain in a hospital, and he worked with another group that obviously was considered a grief counselor. They call them grief counselors when you know, we have grief counselors ready if you're in the school or something and some tragedy happens or whatever. And I always, in the back of my mind, I always thought, just like that verse says, you know, we do not grieve as those who have no hope. And I'm thinking, what do you do when you run across somebody who has no hope? They're not Christians. And yet I'm there as a, quote, grief counselor for them. Or I'm a chaplain in a hospital, and they want to talk to the chaplain. You know, they're sick and they might not make it. And so they want to talk to you. You know, it's like, you know, you say to someone along those lines, you know, there's a humanity that we share together. But at the same time, you know, pick up, we don't share our same hope. I don't want to tell this guy lies just to make him feel good. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to belittle what he's going through or make it trivial because, you know, hey, my problem, you're the one without hope. I mean, you know, you need to get a hope type of thing. And just sort of be callous along those lines. But how do you navigate some of that?
You know, listening to respect as well, because you get an understanding of where they're at. How should you sympathize? You know, understand. It's like Christian and Christ every time. So he's able to sympathize and empathize with him, be able to at least understand the pain. Gee, you understand that, but then when, you know, like Jesse said, privately, comfort them, express that sorrow with them. As they begin to talk to them, they express their understanding, you know. And that's where I'm kind of in that process, trying to understand where they're at, you know, to then give some sort of response to that. You know, on one hand, there's sympathy, pain, or I'm that much better at this, but because I've been in this circumstance, it's tough. Somehow bringing them from the position they're at. Pain that they have, they truly feel, that they truly have to affirm the pain that they have, bring them to a position where they understand God has a solid purpose in that. They may not have the maturity or the disposition to be able to acknowledge that. It's one thing to talk to Jed, who, you know, has been a Christian for many years and has a great loss. That's one conversation. But to talk to somebody else who might be lost or very church, to be able to bring them to that point, they can have some sort of acceptance that is going to be very, very individual. You do have to acknowledge the position. That's real.
You think about the tragedy during the first century when Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he talks about the tower that fell on the 18th. Yeah. But then he talks about another tragedy. What's the second tragedy? He brings them to. He talks about, you know, who was for these people were sinners, right. The 18 that fell on the tower. Then he talks about some people that got killed by Pilate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now why does he bring in those people? I mean, just trying to piggyback it on two different tragedies. Well, one, I mean, is almost providential. I mean, he died because of an accident. But the other one is because of a crime. I mean, you got men on, you know, this guy shedding blood in their sacrifice, whatever, you know, when they killed them there at the altar. So you've got, you know, processing grief, types of grief based upon the senseless, this guy, this 18-year-old, you know, is more along the lines of the Pilate thing. I mean, he did this on purpose. I mean, these kids didn't go there and the roof collapsed on the school and killed 20 kids. I mean, that would be one thing if something like that. Maybe you'd get mad at the engineers, who, you know, but then you got to remotely with a few layers between that and the engineers. But this guy went there, you know, express purpose, locking the door and killing. You know, that's a form of evil that is of that second kind that Christ brings in with Pilate or with those people getting killed offering their sacrifice, if you remember. He brings in both, but he makes the same lesson of saying where these were sinners. Now, would Jesus have given that message to those people that had families that lost 18 or lost family members who were sacrificing to the Lord or something, and Pilate came in and killed them? Now, he gives it to his disciples. It's something to learn from a distance, but it's not something that necessarily Jesus would have given to them. You understand? There's a difference there. Simply because Jesus makes that point about, you know, these people weren't worse sinners than anybody else unless, you know, you repent, you know, you'll likewise perish. He can give that lesson, but you don't at the moment give it to the family. It's not, I mean, you can give it to the family later on, but there's a place for speech when people are suffering and struggling. That's one good thing. Those friends of Job that really got rebuked and raked over the coals, at least they did do right. They knew how to listen. I mean, they didn't come in there and try to preach a sermon the first 5 minutes they met Job, kind of thing. I mean, when you're struggling, you're hurting, best thing for you to do is just to be there with somebody and let them know that you're there and you love them. Rich?
Perhaps there's two case studies to evaluate. What's that church? Somebody can't something go to sexuals and military people. They just,
oh, that's the world.
Oh, that's it. Borough, Kansas, or something like
I
that.
Think that's probably not the yeah. I, you know, I mean, maybe that's not the time. So I mean, we can break that down. Then you look at Jesus with Lazarus, and maybe a case study. I mean, he entered into the grieving, to, you know, the first incident, so to speak. Jesus wept, and then the discussion he had with the closest of Lazarus' kin, his sisters.
Right.
So. And you know, I think you know, evaluation or dissecting of some of the aspects of that might, you know, give us some wisdom there. Now, on the one hand, you have these folks out of that church. I mean, I don't know what drives those folks to do. But whether it's a funeral or not, I don't know that their MO is the best way to win sinners to a kind and gracious Savior. But it does say something. I don't know if they're saying, oh, anything. But, you know, Jesus is, I mean, the mimic.
Yeah.
I mean, you have the general principles, and then we see the general principles here apply. In a sense, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Jesus very handling of the situation. So, yeah. Just the thought.
Play a little, I guess, hypothetical role. One of these kids is your kids. What would get you through the night? What would you lean on? I mean, I understand Jesus. We lean on Jesus. But theology-wise, truth-wise, what would you be able to take to the bank and be able to say, you know, my faith is being stretched? But is it? Is your faith being stretched? Honestly, I think a lot of us, your faith is being strengthened during this time. I mean, I understand a lot of people can lose their faith, as they say. But God's people, these things like this are going to strengthen their faith. What would strengthen it in specific theologically for you on something like this? I remember with Jay, I remember vividly at Jay's house, and Jay, you can jump in anytime, comment on this, but being there and just not saying much because there wasn't much I could say, not because I would tell Jay something he didn't know, kind of get him through the night, sort of say, oh, I didn't know that. Thank you so much. That's really going to help me. You know, it was just one of those things. You just have to be there, just be there with them. But I could tell from Jay is the whole idea of the sovereignty of God, and that, you know, God was not just in control of all the events, but that God was also in the rightful owner of, you know, of his daughter, that kind of thing. And I remember that we're sitting back there, it'll never go away, you know, and just hearing that. It's one of those, you know where you were when 9/11 hit, you know where you were when JFK got shot. I knew where I was when I was with Jay. And I remember what Jay said. It's memorable for me because it was, you know, you hear a lot of sermons, you remember a lot of things, but when someone's going through that kind of pain and that depth of pain and they speak, you're going to listen. Because whatever is coming out, it's probably, you're looking at the deep recesses of a person's soul that's either going to realize there's nothing there in their walk with God, or, and this is where whatever you have from the Lord, this is what's going to get you through for the rest of your life, you know. And picking on Jay a little bit here, but I just remember that with Jay, and it was, you know, I walked away from that just thinking I was going there to help him out. And I was the one that felt like, almost felt like a thief. I felt like I went there and I got all the encouragement and all the building up and all of this. And it's like, gosh, it's just, I was there to give, you know, and she got it all arranged, and I ate a 7-course meal here. So I wasn't expecting that. So, hey, Mark. Hey. Yeah, go ahead, Jay.
Yeah. I remember that time too.
And yeah.
I went through it. It's kind of interesting looking back, but the only thing that helped us was believing in a sovereign God, and not just a sovereign God who allows things to happen. This is a sovereign God that was instrumental in what happened, and you have to have that special God. It can't be the one the Arminians have, where he got tricked by the devil, or if something happened, it was out of his control. God was in total control, and God did it. And the only question was, why? And we can't ask that question. So you settle on that. But the pain's still there. You don't get rid of the pain. But all you know is, it's God letting do what seems good. The other thing I was going to mention, too, the why problem that people have. I remember there was a guy at State Farm, that worked at State Farm. He lost his little boy, and the little boy was about 5 years old when he died. And I tried to console him and tell him about a sovereign God. And he got angry. I mean, really angry. He hated that God. He got up from the table and walked out. And then another experience I had, my neighbor lost her husband, and the church came over, a Presbyterian church. And they told her he was in a better place. And she got furious about that. He said, he was in a better place when he was here with me. And then the other thing is, there's no more pain. They're in heaven. And time heals. The only answer is, God's sovereign. God is in control. And God's instrumental in doing what he did. And I settle for that. And that's it. Yeah, but I don't know what you tell these people that don't have that kind of God. I can't imagine what they're going through. They're going to go through the rest of their lives wondering, why me? Why did that happen to me? Why did it happen to my daughter or my son?
Which tells us what, since we don't know what God they kind of God they believe in, don't open your mouth. Wait, they'll tell you. You'll hear it. But to go in and just trying to, I don't want to say start reciting platitudes, oh, it's going to get better, or time will heal. I mean, you can do stuff like that, but I mean, and you probably mean well, but if you're on the receiving end of that, I don't know what their process. I don't know if I'm dealing with an atheist. I don't know if I'm dealing with somebody with a, you know, a flimsy Arminian theology that, even though I could, I'll be right as rain telling them about the sovereignty of God. And it was the very thing that, that they would need to hear. You realize at that moment, kind of like with Jesus, with the disciples, you can't bear this right now. You can't receive this right now. I'm not saying anybody's going through sorrow can't receive truth. It's just that it's a difficult time. If you haven't been, if you're not there now, if you're not ready now, and when that time happens, you go into it with that theology, and you don't have that kind of theology of God when you go into it, teaching that theology in the heat of the moment of a suffering is very, very difficult to do with them going to be wanting to receive it. As a comfort, I mean, it's kind of like that guy gets up and he's mad at God. It's like, I mean, it's not like I get it, but I understand the depravity of men, and they don't, this guy hadn't been serving that sovereign God. And so now he knows, Romans 1, that God's sovereign, and he knows that God took away his 5-year-old boy or whatever. And you're just going to remind him of something he already knows that's in the back of his mind, that now you're bringing to the front of his mind that, yeah, you know, now that you bring that up, yeah, I really hate him for that, you know. And you begin to realize that, geez, do I really want to have that kind of conversation with this guy coming out with all this vitriol language about God? And I'm thinking I'm trying to comfort him, and all he's doing is railing, you know, blaspheming God during this time, and it's not comforting anything, and it's just increasing, you know, sin accounts and things of that sort. So I'm not saying everybody does that. Obviously, they don't. But if you don't know, that's why you go in and you listen. But I think what Frank said, they'll begin to talk. They'll begin to, and you'll, many times you'll get a why question kind of thing. And the temptation is to take the bait and to go, you know, 3 volumes of Hodges on systematic theology and answer the why question. It's like, I know they're asking why, but many times they're asking why. And then it's like what I had to learn with my girls growing up. Many times they'll ask questions to dad and they're venting. I'm thinking they're asking a question. I mean, if a person asks me a question, I think I'm the answer man. You know, you give them an answer. But it's like, you know, dad, why do you give us an answer all the time? It's like, because you gave me a question. You know, just kind of straightforward kind of guy, you know. You ever see that illustration? It was an illustration of what 2 girls think when they meet each other and what 2 guys think when they meet each other. I don't know if you've seen that illustration. It shows 2 girls and it got all these diagonal lines like, where'd she get these? What'd she get? She has an ankle bracelet. She got this. Oh, look at this. She probably got dyed this. So she's got, it's like all these questions. These women are thinking about when they meet each other. And it, the 2 guys got 1 hour going, hi. That's it. It's just, hi. You know, there's no pretense, no context or whatever. And so sometimes when we hear a question, being a guy, you're thinking, that's a question. They probably just want an answer to it. You know, okay, it's kind of like 2 + 2 = what? 4. You know, you just give the answer. And we can be a little obtuse with that because, you know, there's a whole different layers of levels of communication that many times when you can discern. That's why I think in terms of context now, you know, when there's someone ask a question about it, and you see witnesses do this many times too. Lawyer will ask a question and the witness is not thinking about the question. He's thinking about, why is he asking this question? What are you trying to get help of? What are you trying to dig to? Are you trying to answer that? So they start answering a question that is not even on the table. It's just one of these, well, let me tell you something. You know, so they start giving a narrative about something else. And 10 minutes later, the lawyer comes in and says, I forgot the question. I think the question was, you know, what's your address or something? Something simple. And they're all around the bow going all this stuff. It's like, really, just ask what you, you know. But psychoanalyzing it and trying to figure out, you know, why they're asking these things. Well, same thing happens in grief. Many times when, you know, start talking and they start saying, you know, why this and why that, you know, I didn't deserve this. I didn't. And you hear a lot of bad theology and you'll hear it. You'll hear questions about, you know, why did God do this and that? You got the answer. You know, that's like, Jesus, I know the answer for this. And God's sovereign. I was like, well, God owns the 5-year-old. I mean, I even can see the problem. I said, you know, the guy owned his 5-year-old. Like he invented him. It was his creation. He created him and he has rule over him and he's managing. He owns it. And he took a greater possession of his child than he should have. And he took ownership of that child far greater than what scriptures say you should be taking ownership of. This is my, you know, grandson, this is my son that God's given me, that God owns and God can, you know, he gives and he can take away. And that if he has given me this person, it's a gift. And it's got an expiration. They say all these things I already know built in your theology. And you try to remind yourself of these things while they're alive. And you process it and you say, you know, I have him today. and I might not have him tomorrow. You know, kind of like James 4, you know, if you go to such and such a city, you make a problem. He calls that arrogance. He says, you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. He says, if you're, you know, if you really wise, you say, if, you know, Lord wills, if you'll, you know, we'll do this and that. See, why does he do that? See, he's trying to get them to train their way of thinking so they just don't assume that they own things that they don't own, especially tomorrow. You don't own tomorrow, but you don't own people, and you don't own the people that are closest to you. And so you've got to make space for that. And if you're doing that on a consistent basis, then when God does take something out of your life, you sort of, I'm not saying you won't suffer, you will suffer, but it will be, you'll be able to not be grieved without those who have no hope, as Chris reminds us from 1 Thessalonians 4. You'll be able to process it. You realize, you know, man, I don't know if you know this, was it John Owen that lost how many kids?
Oh,
heavens. I mean, he lost a bunch, 10? Was it, I mean, I don't think he lost all of his kids. I don't think any of them, I don't know. I'm thinking, this guy is like Job. I mean, who loses 10 kids? I mean, who loses 10 kids? And it's like, you never think about that with him, you know? And it's like, gosh, this guy kept on in ministry and he did things and it just didn't, you know, torpedo him. And it's like, undoubtedly, obviously it's the grace of God, but John Owen had a foundation. I mean, he had a theological, I mean, a huge foundation and context for what he, you know, believed about God and what, you know, the people that were in his life and how you love them, but you don't, you know, own them kind of thing, where you start owning things and then, you know, your heart's wrapped around it. And then, you know, God takes them out of your life. And then all of a sudden, you know, you can't function kind of thing. To me, that's a product of a bad theology. It doesn't mean that, hey, everybody's supposed to be, you know, this, I'm going to lose 10 kids. I can march on and be like John Owen. No, but honestly, if God did that for John Owen, that's a miracle and a half, because no one loses 10 kids and goes on without, you know, as if it's nothing's affected. But on the other hand, you realize that, okay, well, then I have to fish or cut bait here, as we would say, when it comes to, you know, this great God that I serve. I call him good. I call him sovereign. I call him all wise. And he took something. But was it a mind? He gave me something to bless me, and now he's taken it from me. So where am I getting this idea that it was mine? See, but for somebody out there who doesn't think like you think, and then you go into that sorrow situation thinking that they think like you think, you're going to be for a rude awakening. All of a sudden you see them railing against God, and, you know, how can God do this? And so I'm not saying you don't preach the truth along these lines, but you might have to wait for the opening for that, if it's even possible to do that. Sometimes, especially with lost people, all you can do is just be there for them. And sometimes they'll ask you questions about things. And I remember this one lady asking me questions about, you know, why God took her mother. You know, I was at the funeral home and everything. But and it was, if God gave me a stroke of wisdom there. And he basically was just saying, in the back of my mind, because I remember this in my conscience, going, don't answer her question. It's like, she was asking the questions. And I don't think she was sitting back and waiting for an answer. But I just basically said, I understand. Yeah, well, you know, I'm praying for you. And that's, I would say that. But I knew, to answer her question, it was, I won't say it was a faux pas question, but it was a question said out of grief. You know, why this, why that, you know, this and that. It's like, I understand. I mean, I was understanding, saying, you really don't want to answer that question. If I give you an answer to that question, you're just going, trampling underfoot like pearls before swines, because you can't receive it. You can't receive it because you don't have a context to love this kind of God. You haven't, you've never loved this kind of God. And so now that he's taken something from you, to you, he's just a big thief. He's stolen from you something that's very, very precious that you had given your life for. And he's taken it and said, this is mine. And I've come to claim ownership of it. Oh, you never got the memo that this never was yours? How come you didn't get the memo of that? Oh, you never went to church. Oh, you never read your Bible. I mean, you really want to go down that line and rebuke her all the way down the line and say, you got here for, because of the many choices you made to neglect God. And now you're caught bankrupt here when it comes to this colossal sorrow in your life. You can't process it. And you're angry at me. And all I've been is God. If I would turn the curtains back, you'd be surprised how much I've been taking care of you and everything in this life. And here I take one thing out of your life, and all of a sudden you're ready to wage war with me. It's like everybody in the world will look at it and say, how in the world did you think that way about God? if all the curtains were pulled back. Of course, all she sees is her loss, and she sees this big bad God took this precious thing from her. So, you know, God's got to be bad, and I can't serve him because he did that. Like my dad went through that. I know it's a personal thing. And so I remember my dad, I wasn't even a Christian then, but I remember my dad going through it. It was impactful. And the things he said, and I remember him. And it was like, in the back of my mind, I wasn't even a Christian, but I was thinking, that's not right. I mean, it was like blaming God because I lost a little brother at 3 years old. And I just remember, I mean, it took my dad out. I mean, I could tell, you know. But once again, it underscores this whole idea of during that moment, your hope and what kind of God you serve is going to come to the surface. And you can't help it. God's going to squeeze it out and you're going to see it. And I'm not saying you fake it till you make it or you're all smiles and saying, yeah, I serve sovereign God, everything's cool, you know. Well, we're going to the movies tonight or not? I mean, you don't trivialize it, but at the same time, I mean, it's, and look, some people, it becomes more of an issue them for them going forward. You got people that are Christians that process it and they'll stay on medication for the rest of their life. Can't handle it without the medication. I understand. Other people, it's like, did the guy even love the kid? I mean, it's like he's popped up, he's ready to go back to work in 2 days and everything's cool and everything and never talks about it. It's like, okay, either he's getting ulcers on the inside, I mean, or he didn't never love this kid because it just seems like he can just kind of process it and go. I don't understand folks like that either. So it's like, I don't know. I mean, maybe God gives the grace. Maybe there's a lot of things that's under the behind the scenes I don't know. You just try to be there for them. So, right.
You know, the interesting thing too is many times, I remember took a survey at a church, still have some results. But what was the subjective of what's going on? Why did you come to this? I don't mean objective, Holy Spirit, subjective going on. And had a variety of answers. So, probably in our church, we probably had about 10 different answers.
Right.
Some of them saw some recurring, saw some better. The point of that for me, and I've done this to other groups, is that people come to me. And so many times people come with really weird ideas and weird motives. We all understand that we have to go through the strength. But ultimately, everyone, many are called, few are chosen. And all of those who enter eternal, enter through the strength. But they may not enter through the strength. They take them some time. So, you know, as we're talking to these folks, we're hoping that they come sometime, maybe 10 minutes from now, 10 years from now. But, you know, when they start asking these questions about God, they know there's a God. Okay? Romans 1 tells us this is being born out right now, this particular moment. You see this idea of death, it's like, you start asking questions of why did God do that? They know that there's a sovereign God. Question itself, they understand that God is in control. And so sometimes, like you said, you know, we give them the answer. They don't want to hear that answer. But, you know, so it is sometimes very tricky, you know, just being comfortable, especially people really either have an immature understanding of God or don't know. It's very difficult because we just know the answer. We've accepted the fact that God is sovereign in all things. The fact that we're sitting here right now having this conversation was ordained before the foundation were. But I can't tell that to someone who just lost a child. As true as that is, you know, they just may not be able to. So, yeah, I mean, just being very careful with them. And, you know, you can say, if they ask the question, why did God do this? You can tell them with all reality and truth. I don't know. Because you don't know why God
specifically.
Specifically. You know, theologically, you don't know what God was trying to do by taking the child. So, you know, sometimes an honest question like that somehow evades the, you know, the detailed answer, but gives it sort of a general answer. But let me tell you, you know, then you can start to introduce them to the God of, you know, the God of love, things of this sort. And by that way, actually leading them to the strength. So yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just different ways of doing that, because not, like I said, not everybody is Jay. You know,
right.
Here's a guy that's not just a Christian. He understands the sovereignty of God
right.
in all of his detail. He accepts that. Yeah. You know, and just not everybody's there trying to string these people. Well, not string, that's a bad thing. Trying to somehow bring these folks along in such a way that you sympathize with where they're at. Get bringing them to that point where they understand who God is, understand the gospel.
You know, someone like Jay, pick on Jay again. You know, if I'm there and I'm thinking and I've got to, I'm going to sit, speak some sort of theology. The first part of my mind is, I'm thinking, I'm going to tell him something true, but is this something going to help him here? It's going to be true, but is it going to comfort him? You know, if I say something about Natalie at that moment, you know, if I say something along the lines of, you know, brother, Natalie was God's creation. That's God's creation. You know, you and Barbara were just, you were part, parcel of the tools God used. But Natalie's God's creation. God brought her on the scene, didn't bring her in, on the scene in 500 AD. Brought on the scene, you know, in the 20th century, and brought on the scene with you. All that was sovereignly orchestrated by God. But you do know that, and we know that, and we know her beginning, but we also know that she had an expiration date. This is it. She was not never meant to live past Tuesday, let's say. This is what God had ordained sovereignly for her. I get it, the way it came about and the way it, you know, she exited this earth was not something that we obviously nobody chose, but you look at it and you say, you know, from a sovereign God perspective, and you're taking comfort in this sovereign God and you're believing he's wise and he's good and he does everything right and he doesn't make any mistakes. Take comfort in the facts. Take comfort in the truth that this was the measure of her life. You had a part in it. You had a great part in it. And you were a witness to it. You were a participant in her love and your love toward her. And then when the time came for it to come to a close, you were there as well. And so if I thought that would comfort him, all that's true, I would say it. Many times in a moment of grief, even a Christian who believes in the sovereignty of God, I have to measure that saying, if that helped Jay, if I'm sitting on the back porch with Jay and we're talking about these things. And so I'm more reticent to say that than to say that, even though I'd have to really be convinced, I think this might help him. I think this might help him tonight realize, you know something, Mark? You're right. I didn't, you know, I think that helps me. If I can get some confidence that he would say that back, then it was well worth saying. But it was like, that's going to be a big deal right now. It's just raw nerves right now. It's just hard to, you know, when you're in a free fall of emotions, it's just hard to see anything in a logical, didactic, teaching, understanding kind of way, unless God just gives you the grace to do that. So that's why we reserve a lot of that type of teaching, understanding kind of thing when we're in the heat of the moment, because people are just, it's just the nerves are raw, especially in something like that in Texas. I mean, I don't know when you get a chance. Maybe when you really feel like, you know, once, maybe years later, and they come around and they ask you questions about it, then you can maybe, you know, say, I even would preface it before I say, okay, I'm going to share some things with you that I'm not really sure you can accept. You know, I would kind of preface that saying, I'm really wondering, I'm going to say some things that it might really provoke you. It's not meant to do that. I'm just going to be honest with you. You asked the question. If you really want a biblical answer, I'm going to give you a biblical answer of why everything took place the way it did. Theologically, I can't tell you specifically, like you brought up, exactly how, you know, this person's death, you know, accomplishes this. I think no one knows that until God shows us these things in eternity. But I can tell you from the Bible, you know, what God is seeking to do, why he did what he does, whether on a big scale or a small scale or evil scale or a good scale or whatever. And I don't see anybody having problems and, you know, racking their brain over on why they win the lottery. Nobody ever thinks about that when good things happen, but it's always when the bad things happen. And I get that. And so I would do a prefacing and I would really have to feel comfortable that I think they would learn from this, not just because it's a teaching moment, but because I think it could be a comforting as they go forward. But many times at the first initial, you know, blush of all of this, I think the best thing to do is to be there and to try to be as quiet as you can. And you're going to get a lot of questions and you might not get any, but if you do, think hard and long before you answer that question. You know, just say, you know, that's a great question. We'll talk about that sometime. Right now, might not be the time. I've had to say that to people too, saying, you know, that's a great question. You know, and it deserves an answer. And we'll talk about that. But right now, you know, it's just, it's, look, you're struggling, you're hurt. I would be, you know, I'm just here to help you out. And I just kind of defer answering that. Unless they're really pressed, or they really, I really felt that, you know, they would get comfort from it. As a general rule, people are just grasping for any kind of comfort at the moment. So,
hey, Mark?
Yeah.
That would have helped. I kind of tell you something that was deep in my heart, though. And this might sound kind of weird, but one of the things I thought about, I knew it was God. And I said, God, why? I did have that question, why? And I said, but it's your will, let the will be done. And the first thing hit my mind was who am I to question God?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even
right
sufficient to question.
Yeah. But that's a testimony, Jay, to what great work God has done in you to cause you to be that humble, to respond that way to, you know, the glory of God. I mean, you're right. That's a great response. And it's also a comfort. I mean, when you can respond that way, that humility is part of your comfort. But I got to tell you, you're a rare bird on that. That's usually not most people's reaction to calamity or something that takes place. But yeah, that's a great answer there, brother. I mean, I'm just.
I got a feeling we all wear rare birds in our group.
Well, I just want to, I think the more we talk about some of these things, because, you know, when these things happen to people, it's not, you know, it hopefully it doesn't take us completely off guard where we, you know, lose all semblance of sanity and rationality or whatever. I mean, I remember, I think I was telling Mike and Bonnie about this Sunday. I took a deposition of a guy. He was a dad who lost his son in a car accident over there on Old Hammond Highway. And the son was the LSU mascot. And he got a horrible death. I mean, I think, I don't know if he was decapitated or whatever in a car accident. But anyway, his dad never got over it. He was, I think, on his fifth lawsuit looking for someone to sue. And I don't know if he was winning or losing or whatever, but you could just tell. I mean, I was there taking a deposition, and it wasn't of him. It was of, I think, somebody else. It might have been. I can't remember. But you could just tell he was a broken man. And this happened, like, son had been dead like 8 or 9 years. And it was like he couldn't get past that, you know. And so while I could think in my mind, hey, he needs to get past this, I'm at the same time I'm thinking, yeah, but that's the grace of God to get past that. I'm assuming an awful lot of grace to get past that. And I'm looking at a guy right now who doesn't have that grace. And so when you don't have the grace, then you're left with the bitterness of the tragedy and trying to blame or fault somebody for it. So thinking that I will get solace and I will get justice and then I'll get peace of mind, you know, if I can just get that, you know, that justice that I'm looking for, I'll be able to function again. And it's like, that's not going to help you. You know, it's not going to bring your son back, as they say. But even if you got a chunk of change from it, $1 million settlement, you know, really? I mean, you're going to now be able to just kind of wake up and live a better life and live a better day because of mammon, because you got more of it, because you made somebody pay, you know, because of what, you know. Think about it. This was an accident. This was like the tower falling on the 18th. But when it's intentional, when you got a guy who is actually out there and actually threw away your son's life and did it on purpose so that he could need $20 for a hit or something, and you look at it and say, he reduced my son's life to $20, and you just really want to wring his neck. And it's like, wow, there was a person that actually took my son's life. I mean, he actually did this. I mean, he did this on purpose or whatever. You know, to me, that's of another level that, you know, goes beyond just a simple hurt of an accident. You got this intention and everything out there. And so, you know, I look at that, and I see, look, got a lot of people out there and they can't, you see a hole in the soul you can drive a truck through and it's never going to go away. Kind of like Jacob with his limp after wrestling with the angel. When you lose somebody like that, you got to be prepared to have a hole in your soul and let God use that for ministry. You learn some of that, losing your husband. And it's just one of those things that, you know, that's going to be me now. That's me with my limp. And it's okay. And I have this hole in my soul. And sometimes I have a good cry, or, you know, sometimes I can't function. Sometimes I, what was it, Spurgeon had a real bad depression or whatever, and some people can't get out of bed. I mean, whatever it might be, you know, you look at it and it's just, I mean, the guy's maybe half the size he used to be, kind of thing. Okay, well, if that's the case, well, let's serve God with the half the size we used to be, and let's do it for the glory of God, half the size we are now. You know, I used to be a size of a gallon, but now I'm cut down to a quart size, all right? But I'm going to play, praise God, quart size for the rest of my life, okay? In other words, you take the mentality of, you know, God gives me a lemon, I make lemonade, and I never had this lemon before. Well, then you make the best lemonade you can, you go forward with it, and you do it for the glory of God. Let me tell you something, God get way more glory out of your lemonade because of your tragedy than he ever did. So whatever you were doing before, you had the lemons and the lemonade. So you got to just, you march forward with that, you know? Knowing that going in, what you say to people during their time of grief, you just have to be judicious with it and be praying and asking God for that kind of wisdom. So, anybody else on this? I didn't want to take up the whole time, but I just thought, especially with that kind of tragedy like that, and, you know, when you might be confronted with it, that you know how to hopefully have some tidbits of wisdom to be able to know what to say and what not to say.
Jack called me to tell me about Jay's tragedy. It's weird about the human thing. It's like he tells you and then you say, what? And it's like he has to say it again for it to, like, and then just the shock, I guess, you know, I'm sure the families, when they just that. But the shock thing, though, is what is kind of what's interesting, because it kind of shows you where you're at with God. It reminds you that even though this is tragic, God, it's, as far as personally, it's like, is he in control? You know, yeah, he's in control, because that's what the shock is like. How can these things happen? You know, the degree is such level that it has this impact on you. And you almost have to kind of gather yourself, you know. And then, like you said, what's your theology? You see it in yourself. You're like, okay, God is in control, you know. Or if you didn't have that, what would you think? I don't know. But you can see it in yourself that when these things happen, it's like, well, you know, the Lord is. And then you try to find if you can console or comfort, you know, the recipient, you know, any way that's, you know, possible, at least pray.
You know, I think of what Jay said when Jay lost his daughter, Natalie. And then I think about what you said when you lost Rex, your husband, and the theology, not so much you had, but you were being bombarded with the health and wealth people. Mm-hmm. And what they were trying to tell you by way of, I guess, comfort from their perspective. Mm-hmm. And in reality, it was adding on to your misery. It was like, really? I mean, if you'd had more faith, you know, you could have saved him from his cancer, you know? And I'm thinking, wow, you're going to just double down on her being a cause of his demise. I mean, it's like, because she didn't have enough faith, you know?
Well, I mean, if I can testify, the pastor actually told me it was not God's will that Rex died. And so that was kind of a turn. But I'm just thinking what you said about it's grace. It's all grace. Because if it wasn't for grace, Jack wouldn't have come to my house and said, you want to come to Boston. You know, and then I wouldn't have found such a rich mine of truth that I knew was true, but I just had never heard it. But I knew that it was true. And it was exactly what I needed. Even though, you know, it took 11 years. And I've told my sister, I said, I think I was mentally ill for a long time. And I mean that tongue in cheek, but really. But it's God's grace that I believe what I was taught. And I believed it so much so that it was a comfort to me. I wasn't angry at God. Now, Jay said something about asking God why. I remember asking God, what are you thinking? But, you know, and I was just thinking that when people were grieving, first thing you have to do is try to figure out, who are they mad at? Are they mad at God, or are they mad at the person, you know, like this family, that person that took away somebody they love, not somebody they could choke, maybe not the invisible God, you know. And then I was thinking about Job's wife. Curse God. She didn't say curse Satan. She said curse God and die. And he said, you talk like a crazy woman. So look at the contrast. They both lost their children. Both lost their children. Only Job got the grace. You know, but even then he asked God why. And then when God took the time to you know, show him some things. He said, I don't know what I'm talking about. That's humility.
That's humility. Yeah.
So, but I was just thinking, I really appreciated when people would say, I don't know how you feel. So, you know, I've learned, don't go up to a person, even if I would go to another widow, don't say, I know how you feel. No, you don't. Because relationship's different. They're different in their theology and their system and their strengths and their weaknesses. So I would say, I said, really can't wrap my head around this anymore. And just leave it at that. But the other thing that I used to hate, don't cry. Don't cry. You know, don't ever tell people not to cry. I remember one person said, well, just cheer up. You're going to find another husband. I'm like, it's not like your dog got run over by a car. You go to the town and get another one. But anyway, I just, you know, it just, this is real sobering. And it's really good for me to think back on the things that you're laying out. I'm like, yeah, see what God did. See, Claire, you didn't wrap your car around a tree on purpose, did you? Oh, you just keep coming back from work for more.
I remember going to the funeral home. I would go to the funeral home. It's the day of the wake. Let's say the wake is from 10 to 12 or something. You get to go there early. You go there at night because you get the family gets to view the body. And they have their time of grieving before the folks get there at 10. Sometimes they want me to be there or, you know, someone there with them at 9. And you're right. It ain't like when the public shows up. When the public shows up, it pretty much is a little bit more composed, and they've kind of gotten a lot of the most, say, all their grieving out, but a lot of the initial, you know, first tsunami wave of it. And so it's not just a shock where everybody's coming in at the same time and looking at this person's body or whatever. But I remember. You know, you give the advice even during that time where you're going to have people come in. You're going to be exhausted because you'll be shaking hands and talking, and they'll be reliving memories and things of the sort. And try to tell the folks in the family. Now remember, they're going to try and comfort you, and they're not going to. They're going to add to your misery because they're going to say things like, "Hey, cheer up," but you realize, geez, really. I can't believe this person told me to cheer up, you know, like I've got an obligation now to just cheer up because they told me to cheer up. Or, you know, well, it could be worse. You know, they try to put some, you know, Pollyanna, you know, optimism to it. I said, you're going to have people who are going to say things like, don't let it get to you, you know, because they just don't know how to handle grief and they don't know how to comfort. They're probably trying. It's their best effort, but it's almost like, I feel bad for folks that have to go through that because it's like they got to subject themselves to, you know, Job's three friends that somehow is going to try and blame them or try to, you know, say little platitudes or things because they don't even know. It's not like they had to went through a course on how to deal with grief. But sometimes that's just as much as a hindrance as the actual sorrow itself that they're trying to process. So, but yeah, I just thought that was interesting what you were saying about, especially when they're piling on and talking about, you know, he was not supposed to die kind of thing. It's like, well, wait a minute. So why did he die? Well, if you'd have had more faith, you know, kind of thing.
So, that's geez. Why I look for the exit
sign. Yeah. So.
But, you know, at the same time now, when I go to a funeral and the widow is sitting there, no matter if she's a believer or not, I will tell her, like, just want to let you know, the people behind me, they're going to say really stupid things. Just forgive them.
That's right. Exactly.
Just forgive them. That's they right. don't know.
That's right. So, good point. Anybody else? Anybody else on Zoom? I noticed this little passage here I have in James chapter 4. We talked a little bit about it, but if we change the language here, come now you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there, engage in business, and make a profit. Now, think about the statement this guy is saying. And, of course, he's going to say that this person, you who say, okay, who have this kind of philosophy, he says, yet you do not know. You do not know what your life, he doesn't say his business, your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor. It's not his business is a vapor. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. He said, instead, now notice, you ought to say, this is the theology the man should be working off of. But it's this theology he's working off of. And he wonders why he's going to hate God when there's a tragedy or his business fails or whatever else happens. So if this is your theology, verse 15, if the Lord wills, we will live. Didn't he say anything about we will profit from a business venture? We will live and also do this or that. You heard Jay say this. We will live and also do this or that. In that humility statement, he said, who am I to question this great God who gave me, you know, Natalie for so many years? Wow. I want to celebrate her life. I want to look at the cup half filled. I want to be able to say, look, and I got to know this wonderful person named Natalie, my daughter, for all these years. And I get it. I got to know her as dad. No one else got to know his dad. And I'm so thankful. I'm so blessed, Lord, that you gave me that. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Naked, from, you know, coming from the womb, you know, naked we return to the grave. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I mean, that type of humility comes from this type of theology. See, but you're not going to say this in verse 15. If the Lord will, sovereignty, we will do this and we'll do that. Unless you're practicing that now before any of this. Now, see, if I change the language in verse 13 to say, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, I have a family that we will be able to spend together for the next 30 years and engage and having children and grandchildren and being able to make money and being able to retire and being able to enjoy each other and live to ripe old ages of 110 and then depart. I'll just change up the language from a guy making engaging in business and making a profit and someone thinking they've got their life ahead with all of the little accoutrements of what it means to have like a lovely house and a lovely family and a lovely, you know, no one's ever sick about anything. But once again, there's the verse 14. Number one, you don't know what your life's like tomorrow. You know that. Now, lost people know that. You don't need systematic theology to tell you, really? I kind of thought I knew that. I got my day timer. I've already scheduled tomorrow. I know what my appointments are. And so, you know, God's he's on the hook to give me these things that I know about tomorrow. It's on my day timer. And you start thinking like that, leaving God out, that number one, the most obvious common sense thing in verse 14 is that my life's a vapor and I'm just here for a little while. How am I spending it? But then number two, the whole idea about God being in the picture of if the Lord wills, I'll be able to do that. And to not do that, as he says, you boast. I think that this is a boasting here. And this is what it's based upon in your arrogance. I'm saying something because I'm believing something. Arrogance. I'm boasting. I'm speaking and I'm saying these outrageous things in verse 13. We're going to such and such a city. I'm going to spend a year there. I'm going to engage in business. I'm going to make a profit. I'm going to come back. It's like, really? Wow. Well, you don't even know you'll make the car out of the garage into the road and get hit. You don't have no clue, but yet you're making these grandiose statements. And you get on Nebuchadnezzar who says, look at this great empire I've built with my hands, right? You're the Nebuchadnezzar. You make a statement like that, you're no different than Nebuchadnezzar, who makes this outlandish statement about, you know, his pride and things of this sort. And God strikes him down. And notice what happens. He loses his mental abilities. You want to talk about mental health? Here it is. And a lot of times it starts with a lot of stuff that people think they're entitled to. And they're not, and they don't get it. It gets taken away and they go off the deep end. They can't handle it because they're entitled. Their life is a vapor. It begins to vanish away. And they don't have that humility in verse 15. And see, here's the problem. If you don't have, this is the humility that's the opposite of the arrogance. That's right here in verse 16. Because he says, all such boasting is evil. Now, when you're thinking like this and this boasting that you're doing, you do it and you just do it in such a way that you don't think twice about it. Isn't God supposed to judge that as sin? How do you think he judges it as sin? Kills a man and puts him in hell. No, he does what he says here in verse 13. He takes away these things. All of a sudden he takes it away. The guy's not boasting anymore about tomorrow. He's railing against God because God didn't give him tomorrow. God didn't give him a prophet because he didn't give him a business. He didn't give him a year. All of a sudden he gets diagnosed. I remember a guy, another guy. I mean, you run across these people. I mean, that guy had the world by the tail, you know, and he's making money hand over fist. I mean, it's not funny. These people make $3 million in a year, you know, lawyers and things of this sort. And you just could tell, I mean, this guy was just, this is what's owed me kind of thing. And he develops brain cancer in 6 weeks instead. And I'm thinking, I bet that wasn't on the daytime. I bet that wasn't included in his thinking for what's going to happen on the coming year. No one puts that in their day. But it's like, you should have it in your mental day timer that, you know, I have to, I might not make it home. But don't make it home. I want to let you guys know. I love you very much. See you in heaven. But I got to tell you, you tell the folks you love, you act like today's your last day. And you treat people as if it might be your last day. Because it very well could be. But that's also a form of humility in verse 15. If the Lord wills, I'll live. I'll be able to make it home. I might tomorrow. I got two depositions scheduled at 10 and 2 tomorrow, right down the road here. Maybe God may give me the grace, and maybe I'll take them tomorrow. I don't know. I might not be able to make it. Might not be able to take those depots. So somebody else has to take them. And somebody else has to prove the ones that got the house. It'll probably be you. So you got to ship them out. So. But then notice verse 17. And here's the big principle. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do. Now, in context, what's the right thing to do? Right here, all of this up here. You don't make statements like this as if you own tomorrow, number one. Number two, you have to take full understanding that your life is a vapor. It's going to be gone in a few short years. I mean, it's very easy to start thinking about, you know, our country and where it's going and everything. You ain't going to be around to see it. You might have 5 months at the best, 5 minutes left. I mean, you have no clue where it's going to go. And is that going to be somewhere on your docket to think about when you're standing before God on Judgment Day? Someone else is running it. So it's like, I'm not saying we don't think about it at all, but it's like, think, your life is a vapor. All these big things that we think is going to take centuries, it's like, you're not going to be around to see it. You're not even going to be, or you can even be around to see your grandkids grow up, if you even got to have grandkids. So that's a big right thing to do, is I got to have the mental theology of knowing that, number one, look at my life. My life is a vapor, kind of like what Jay said. You kind of have to walk with your hat in your hand. If the Lord wills, I will be able to live and also do this and that. You know, I have money and I have some food and I have a roof over my head. Wow, I'm the blessed of all people. I don't need to concern myself with big and bad things out there. This is what I have. I'm thankful. And if I boast, verse 16, I boast in the Lord. I don't boast in my arrogance thinking that I own tomorrow. And I don't boast in my arrogance thinking that my life's not a vapor. It's a rock. It's a granite, you know, rock of Gibraltar. And it's not. And so, therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do, that's the right thing to do. It does not do it. That means, does not do it. You have to do it. Do what? Think along these lines. And if you don't train yourself to think along those lines, you're training yourself to sin. I'm just taking the text and going with it phrase by phrase. And so in this area up here, I'm not saying these people who lost their kids, you know, third and fourth graders or whatever in this class, you know, are in this position. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying that your theology will be shown during that time. Your humility will come out. Like John the Baptist, you know, what do we have that hasn't been first given to us? So we know that everything we have has been given to you. Think about that now. Everything Rich has been given to Rich. Tell me one thing Rich has that hasn't been given to him. Hasn't been given. Everything he has, I mean, his kids, his wife, his health, everything, money, all that's been given to him by somebody else, God. And it's been given to him for a short amount of time. How do I know? It says in verse 14, his life's a vapor. All those things that's been given to Rich eventually are going to be taken from Rich. Now, they can be taken from Rich by God taking Rich out of the picture, then they're all taken from Rich. Or they can be taken from Rich where God takes those things and Rich still stays in the picture. Either way, it's going to happen to Rich. Now, if Rich has got his head on straight, he knows that's coming down the pike. It's coming down for everybody. So when I say in verse 13, I'm going to be able to do this, this, and this, and all these other things, maybe, like it says in verse 15, well, the Lord wills. I will be able to live. I'll have a life. I'll have health. Maybe I'll have my kids. Maybe I'll have my wife. Maybe, you know, maybe. And says, we will live and also do this or that. Maybe I'll be able to do that. Maybe the Lord will give grace to do that. Maybe. You might not, but maybe. You can always hope. those kind of things. But to do anything beyond that is, I mean, you're setting yourself up and you're boasting in your arrogance. If you do that and you think arrogance and that boasting, which is evil, is going to save you in the day of calamity, it's going to expose that arrogance and that boasting. You don't want that to happen.
But Laura had the COVID thing, trying to learn lessons from that experience. It's, you know, knowing my mind, and Lord really helped me out if I can verbalize it right. But anyways, you left me here, so it's kind of like, well, what should I be doing? My time and things. And one of the things that I guess I learned, I'm still learning, will learn the rest of my life, was that you can be real busy with your day, with what you think you got, everything you got to get done. And we all are very busy these days, I know. And it just seemed like that the lesson was that was really God's business, how the day goes. My business is to focus on being thankful and being humble and being gracious and wanting Christ to actually be glorified in my life. And it seemed like that's a simple thing, but it really is. Just to walk humbly and thankfully all day long is really hard to do.
Yeah. Sure.
Even if you did 24 seconds, just 1 second now, you didn't find perfection. But anyway, just want to be humble and grateful for everything the Lord does in your life, everything. And it's so easy. And what he exposes by my murmuring. Every time I murmur, it's just like a big rebuke. You know, I'm like, what are you murmuring? You have everything in Christ. What are you murmuring about?
Yeah. Sure. That's a good point. I mean, once again, if you think about murmuring, you're basically saying, I deserve something. I'm not getting it. And I'm mad. I'm complaining. I'm grumbling like those people in the wilderness because I deserve water. I deserve food. I deserve whatever. And I'm not getting it. And I'm mad at God because he didn't give it to me. So, you know, God, you owe me. See, entitlement. And so when you have that entitlement kind of mentality, it's the opposite of humility. And the more you focus on that, the more narcissistic you get, which is the essence of arrogance and pride. And I call it the Nebuchadnezzar syndrome. You become this megalomaniac, and then everybody around you has to use your preferred pronouns, has to use your preferred. And think about this. Once you start talking about preferred pronouns, why not talk about preferred titles? I think you will address me as sir. You'll address me as reverend. You'll address me as God. You'll address me as king. I mean, why not just tell people to address you as all these other things that you want to put in front of your name? Kind of like, talk about narcissism. But once again, it's built upon the back of arrogance. And I'll call that kind of boasting, which is boasting, is that it flies in the face of humility and flies in the face of these truths about vapor. And no wonder they can't process sorrow, because this is the theology they built their house upon. And it'll come crashing down. So. Anybody else before we close? Can we use our time for this? I do have a handout that I'll give to y'all to take home with you to look at. And I'll pull it up on the screen for those on Zoom for you to look at. I thought it was a totally different subject, but it was an interesting article. I thought I kind of like Samuel Say. If anybody knows who Samuel Say is, brother in Canada who writes, good brother, just, you know, simple stuff. Got converted, a great testimony in Guyana in South America, and through the providence of God winds up in Canada. Just got some simple wisdom, but I like it. And we have a handout about it, and I thought it was pretty good. And I can show it to the folks online if you want to take a look at it to see what we're going to be reading as a take on. But anything else before we close on this subject here? I just thought it was, you know, with what took place, you know, once again, you know, whether we didn't do this with the Sandy Hook thing or whatever. But I just thought it would be profitable for us to because you never know when you're going to have to process grief or help somebody else process grief. And there's no right or wrong, but yet at the same time, you're going to see things and hear things that be careful what you say in return by way of comfort, consolation. You can be right as rain, but it doesn't necessarily mean you'll be a good teacher or at least a good counselor or comforter during that time. That's, you want to be used by the Lord so it's effective. So, anybody online? Comments? Any other prayer requests before we close? Okay. Let's pray. Jack, close us from. Thanks.
Father, we thank you for the word tonight and answered our prayer to stir us and awaken us to consider our life, vapors, distance, unless instructed by your word, we just maybe become stunned, angry, bitter, and unresponsive. Help us, Father, to see your will and your ways for good. You work all things for good, glory. Give us the strength and the settlements to trust you and believe. Give us that grace. Thank you for the examples in Scripture, Lord, read in one another's lives. The words have great courage and strength. We pray that by the word in our heart is breaking. So sad and angry and fearful. May find you faith. Your promise to be with us to the end. Promise to be faithful. We're looking to you for that great day to which make our life and our latter years better, our best years. But you, Father, thank you. Love you. Loved us in giving us your own sins, your only Son taking our sins. Pray in the precious life. But Jesus Christ.